This is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil. In the coming hours, the president of China is expected to arrive in Russia for a meeting with Russian President Vladimir Putin, and U.S. officials are waiting for an update. AP correspondent Jackie Quinn reports.
The Russian invasion of Ukraine is expected to dominate the meeting between visiting Chinese leader Xi Jinping and Russia's Vladimir Putin in Moscow. U.S. National Security Council spokesman John Kirby says there are concerns China may agree to help Putin in the war effort.
China has not condemned Putin's invasion of Ukraine. They are still buying Russian oil and energy resources.
He tells Fox News Sunday experts wonder if there will be talk of a China-brokered ceasefire, which would give Putin a strategic advantage. Since President Xi is talking to Russia, will there be a call with President Biden?
He does want to set up another chance to talk to President. She and I suspect that will happen.
I'm Jackie Quinn.
North Korean state media reported on Monday that leader Kim Jong-un led 2 days of military drills simulating a nuclear counterattack over the weekend. VOA's Marissa Melton tells us more.
State media KCNA reported that the drills included the firing of a ballistic missile carrying a mock nuclear warhead. The drills were the fourth show of force from Pyongyang in a week. Seoul's Joint Chiefs of Staff said Sunday that the short-range ballistic missile fired by Pyongyang flew 800 kilometers or 500 miles before landing in the East Sea, also known as the Sea of Japan. Tokyo has also condemned the launch, as did the U.S. military's Indo-Pacific Command. North Korea's drills took place as South Korea and the United States staged their own military maneuvers. 11 days of joint drills known as Freedom Shield. It's their largest set of joint exercises in 5 years. Marissa Melton, VOA News.
And this is VOA News. U.S. President Joe Biden spoke Sunday with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to express concern over his government's planned overhaul of the country's judicial system that sparked widespread protests across Israel and encouraged compromise. The White House said Biden reiterated U.S. concerns about the measure to roll back the judiciary's insulation from the country's political system. In a call, a senior administration official described as candid and constructive. There was no immediate indication that Netanyahu was shying away from the action after rejecting a compromise last week offered by the country's figurehead president. Swiss President Alain Berset said banking giant UBS is acquiring its smaller rival Credit Suisse for almost $3.25 billion in an effort to avoid further market-shaking turmoil in the global banking. Combination of the two banks and best-known Swiss banks, each with storied histories dating back to the mid-19th century, amounts to a thunderclap for Switzerland's reputation as a global financial center, leaving it on the cusp of having a single national champion in banking. While UBS is buying Credit Suisse, UBS officials said that they plan to sell off parts of it or reduce the size of the bank over the coming months and years. The publication of a major new UN report on climate change is being held up by a battle between rich and developing countries over emissions targets and financial aid to vulnerable nations. AP correspondent Charles de la Desma reporting.
The Russian invasion of Ukraine is expected to dominate the meeting between...
Meanwhile, a photo appearing on protest signs and online in France shows President Emmanuel Macron sitting on piles of garbage. The image references the trash going uncollected with sanitation workers on strike, but also what many French people think about their 45-year-old leader. Macron hoped that his push to raise a retirement age from 62 to 64 would cement his legacy as a president who transformed France's economy for the 21st century. Instead, he finds his leadership contested both in parliament and on the streets of major cities. His decision to force a pension reform bill through without a vote could hamper his government's ability to pass legislation for the remaining 4 years of his term. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Thank you. Today is Monday, March 20th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Ofor in Washington. Coming up in the next half hour, the UN announces an extension of the Russia-Ukraine Green Deal as Kyiv continues its defense of Bakhmut.
The spokesman for Ukraine's Eastern Group of Forces says Russian troops are tactically unable to complete the capture of Bakhmut.
The U.S. marks the anniversary of the invasion of Iraq as questions continue over its outcome.
At this hour, American and coalition forces are in the early stages of military operations to disarm Iraq, to free its people, and to defend the world from grave danger.
And member nations of the UN approve a major new report on climate change. We'll have these stories and more next on International Edition. Stay tuned. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan and United Nations officials say an unprecedented wartime deal that allows grain to flow from Ukraine to countries in Africa, the Middle East and Asia has been extended. Ukraine announced a 120-day extension on Saturday, the day the deal was set to expire. A Russian Foreign Ministry spokesperson says Moscow agreed to a 60-day renewal. This has Kyiv restated its determination to defend the eastern city of Bakhmut. Associated Press correspondent Charles Teladesma reports.
The spokesman for Ukraine's Eastern Group of Forces says Russian troops are tactically unable to complete the capture of Bakhmut. Serhiy Cherevaty said on Ukrainian TV, yes, there are very active battles. The Russians continue to carry out several dozen attacks by inertia, but they suffer huge losses, adding that the ingenuity of the Ukrainian defense succeeds in bleeding the enemy and breaking his fighting spirit. Meanwhile, Ukrainian regional authorities allege Russian forces purposely shelled a house in a suburb of the city of Kherson, trapping a woman under the rubble. The resident of Bilozerka, 9 miles west of the region's namesake capital, was hospitalized after being pulled from the wreckage. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
Monday marks 20 years since U.S. President George W. Bush ordered the invasion of Iraq. American forces remain in the country today, not as foe as was the case in 2023, but now as a key partner. VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Bob takes a look at the war's toll on both countries.
At this hour, American and coalition forces are in the early stages of military operations to disarm Iraq, to free its people, and to defend the world from grave danger.
A shock-and-awe bombing campaign lit up Baghdad to start the war 20 years ago. The U.S. military toppled the regime of Saddam Hussein and ultimately captured the deposed dictator. Iraqis who lived through his reign say it was horrific and brutal. President George W. Bush declared mission accomplished on May 1, 2003. But the war dragged on, as remnants of Saddam's Ba'athist party and other insurgents continued to fight U.S. and allied forces. Iraq's weapons of mass destruction never materialized, but the human cost for Iraqi citizens and American soldiers grew. Critics, including former Obama administration Secretary of State Jim Steinberg, call the U.S. intervention in Iraq unwise.
There are two kinds of critiques. One, which is there was no justification for doing it all in the first place, or which is one kind of critique, and the other is that, well, there was a justification, but only if you were capable of making sure that what came after it was not worse than what happened before.
President Barack Obama withdrew U.S. forces from Iraq in late 2011, only to re-enter the country 3 years later to fight an Islamic State insurgency that rose amid political unrest. Islamic State took control of Mosul and several large areas of Iraq before its ultimate defeat there in 2017. The U.S. formally ended its combat mission in Iraq in 2021, and about 2,500 U.S. troops remain to advise Iraqis on how best to counter pockets of Islamic State. Speaking to the Al Hora TV channel this month, Iraq's president said Iraqi citizens now have more freedom than they did in the era of Saddam.
After overcoming the hardships of the past two decades, Iraqis are enjoying peace and stability, and the government is focusing on improving the services and infrastructure in the country.
But Sama Aziz, who fled Iraq in 2006 and is the wife of Ahmed al-Suhal, says Iraqis are still suffering.
It's really the same. Like, what's happening in Iraq right now is no different than what was happening in Saddam Hussein's time.
More than 4,000 U.S. troops died in Iraq, along with tens of thousands of Iraqi civilians. Carla Babb, VOA News, Washington.
And as the U.S. marks the 20th anniversary of the invasion of Iraq, VOA's Encounter program host Carol Castiel spoke with veteran Middle East observers Ellen Lepson, director of the Center for Security Policy Studies at George Mason University, and Rhonda Slim, director of the Conflict Resolution and Track 2 Dialogues program at the Middle East Institute, about the shifting rationales for the George W. Bush's administration's invasion of Iraq and the gains and challenges that remain for a country which has resumed its place in the Arab world.
Melvin Loeffler, a very distinguished emeritus professor at the University of Virginia, has now come out with a new book arguing that, first of all, Bush was in charge. He was not being manipulated by his advisors, and that his primary motivation was fear and the strong desire to prevent another 9/11. How that got transferred onto Iraq is obviously, there's a lot of analytic flaws and incorrect assumptions, et cetera. That's one interpretation. But we know that in the public discourse, and I would still hold the Bush administration responsible for making arguments to the public to win support for what they were about to do. You can't take away that it was about the freedom agenda. There had been success of democratization in Eastern Europe, and there was a belief that somehow the Middle East, if we could just peel off, remove the worst of the dictators, that somehow there'd be this rush towards democratic culture in the Middle East, and the WMD question, where we didn't want to believe the answers that the UN was giving us, that these programs were dormant, that there really wasn't any active production of weapons of mass destruction. So I don't give them a pass on trying to make both the democracy and the WMD argument. My colleague Ahsen Butt has written to me what might be a very compelling way to think about this, which is that 9/11 truly was the trauma. It truly was the organizing motivation for everybody in the Bush team, whether you were a neocon ideologue or something else, but that it was an instinctive desire to demonstrate that the United States still had dominant power, that we could deter and intimidate any other actor from, don't you dare do what Al-Qaeda did. And so it was this desire to kind of reassert American hegemony. The irony and the tragedy of it all is that by doing so, we actually brought an end to the period of the single superpower, that the Iraq War had such tragic consequences that it really was an end of an era of American supremacy, not the continuation of it.
Rhonda Slim, would please go ahead.
But the freedom agenda came after the UN failed to find WMD. It was a spin in order to justify a war that cost eventually trillions and hundreds of thousands of deaths, especially on the Iraqi side. And so I don't have a say on, you know, which of these theories really is what compelled Bush. But I tend to believe at least the narrative that Alan just talked about, that he was in charge. The president was in charge, and he was not manipulated by his advisors, as some of the talk at the time, that it was mostly Dick Cheney and Rumsfeld who were pushing Bush into the war in Iraq. Also, some of the narrative we're getting today about people at the time who were in contact with Tony Blair, the British Prime Minister, or people who were at the time in intelligence services, who are saying basically 3 days after 9/11, the decision was made to go to war in Iraq. And then the rationale was found or was created for going to war. But we need to understand that the freedom agenda, which eventually became the rubric under which all of this fought, and which, in my opinion, set back the freedom agenda in the region. In fact, it equated freedom and democracy in the region with the war in Iraq, which, in my opinion, delayed the Arab Spring by a few years. I would argue that the Arab Spring could have happened earlier because the domestic factors for the Arab Spring in the different countries, poor governance, corruption, unemployment, educated youth yearning for a better future, dignity issues were there. But I think the Iraq war delayed that reckoning in each of these countries that went through the Arab Spring later, but did not prevent it. Because the other thing of the Iraq war is that it showed for the Arab public that these regimes, especially regimes like the Ba'athist in Iraq, or like Mubarak at the time in Egypt, or like Muammar al-Qaddafi in Libya, were really paper tigers. You know, they were not really strong regime and could be overcome through sustained action. So the takeaway from Iraq about democracy agenda and about the democracy in the region is to twofold is a mixed takeaway. On one hand, it delayed it by a few years, but on the other hand, it brought down the wall of fear that leaders like Saddam, like Mubarak, like Gaddafi had erected over the years between them and their citizens.
That's Rhonda Slim, the Director of Conflict Resolution and Track 2 Program at Middle East Institute, and Aileen Lapson, the Director of the Security Studies Program at George Mason University in Virginia. They spoke with the host of VOA's Encounter program, Carol Castiel. Listen to the complete discussion on our website, voaafrica.com/encounter. Governments gave their blessing Sunday to a new major UN report on climate change after approval was held up by a battle between rich and developing countries over emission targets and financial aid to vulnerable nations. The report by hundreds of the world's top scientists was supposed to be approved by government delegations Friday. The deadline was repeatedly extended as officials from big nations such as China, Brazil, Saudi Arabia, as well as the United States and the European Union, haggled over key phrases in the text. The report by the UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change caps a series that digests research on global warming compiled since 2015. This is VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Afo in Washington. The International Criminal Court issued an arrest warrant for Russian President Vladimir Putin and Russian official Maria Lvova-Belova for an alleged plot to deport Ukrainian children to Russia. The court said that there was, quote, reasonable grounds, unquote, to believe Putin bears individual responsibility for the alleged crimes. These are the first charges to be formally lodged against Putin since Russia's invasion of Ukraine last year. He's the third serving president to be target of ICC arrest warrant after two African leaders. VOA's Carol Van Dam asked Human Rights Watch researcher Yulia Godbunov about the likelihood of Putin ever appearing in The Hague.
Look, I think that it's symbolically it is very important that this arrest warrant had been issued, and I think it sends a very clear signal to other perpetrators of serious crimes, international crimes committed in Ukraine by Russian forces, that, you know, this is a very clear possibility that this may happen to them. And, you know, it's true that securing arrests is one of the most difficult challenges faced by the ICC. And the reason for that is because the court does not have its own police force, and it really has to rely on governments and the international community to enforce the warrants and to effect arrests. But at the same time, we can't really speculate. As you pointed out, the past experience shows that it is in fact unlikely that Vladimir Putin will stand trial. However, international response in general to this war has been completely unprecedented. So I don't think we should rule it out. And again, the symbolic significance of this, and also it's an illustration that no one is above the law. No government official, including sitting government officials, no matter how senior, is above the law.
That's Yulia Gubanov, a Human Rights Watch researcher based in Europe. She was speaking with my colleague, Carol Van Dam. Turkish Foreign Minister Mevlut Cavusoglu paid a visit to Cairo to make a push to restore full diplomatic relations between the two countries despite Ankara's ongoing support for the Muslim Brotherhood's group. Relations between Turkey and Egypt have been strained for almost 10 years after the ouster from power of the Muslim Brotherhood and former Egyptian President Mohamed Morsi. Cavusoglu said in a joint news conference with Egyptian counterpart Sameh Sukri that Turkey was, quote, using its influence to extend a Black Sea grain deal permitting the export of grain from Ukraine, unquote, in his role as a mediator between Moscow and Kyiv. Edward Uranian reports for VOA from Cairo.
The mere fact that Egyptian Foreign Minister Sameh Sukri and Turkish Foreign Minister Mevlut Cavusoglu were able to hold the joint news conference in Cairo indicates a sea change between the two countries after almost 10 years of mutual recriminations and frazzled relations that followed the ouster of former Muslim Brotherhood President Mohamed Morsi in July 2013. Both diplomats hinted that full diplomatic relations will soon be restored amid a general thaw of hostilities throughout the Middle East following the recent agreement between Iran and Saudi Arabia to resume diplomatic ties severed in 2016. One of the key points that Cavusoglu stressed to journalists in Cairo was the dangerous ramifications of the Russia-Ukraine conflict and the need to avoid a more serious, potentially nuclear conflict. He went on to say that Ankara's push to gain Russia's agreement on renewing a Black Sea grain deal that allows Ukraine to export grain to various Middle Eastern and Third World countries, including Egypt. He says that while Ankara is hosting talks over the situation at Ukraine's Zaporizhia nuclear power plant, it also is making an intense effort with Russia to permit the extension of the Black Sea grain sale agreement. Russia's ambassador to the UN has said that Moscow agreed to extending the agreement for 2 months rather than the 120 days that was requested. Egyptian political sociologist Said Sadek tells VOA there is a move afoot in the Middle East to ease tensions that have been brewing between regional states like Egypt and Turkey, and that Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan is especially eager to demonstrate his ability to bridge the gap between various hostile states, both regionally and internationally.
Turkey wants to say that I am an important card in regional and international political affairs, and I play a very important strategic role in mediating between the East and the West, despite the fact that I am a member of NATO. I can also speak to Putin when many Western leaders cannot speak directly today to Putin.
Paul Sullivan, a Washington-based Middle East analyst who is on the Atlantic Council, told VOA that an extension of the Black Sea grain agreement is a major relief for Egypt because the Russian war on Ukraine has caused great shocks to food, energy, and other markets. Egypt's runaway inflation can be traced back to the war, creating a huge burden for Egyptians, he underscores. Even the mothers and dads in neighborhoods in the countryside understand how the war has made their lives more difficult. Egypt buys much of its grain and sunflower oil from Ukraine, and it's the world's largest wheat importer, ahead of even China. Keeping the Black Sea deal going, he argues, is important for the health and well-being of all Egyptians who have had enough shocks lately and need a break from food prices and food insecurity. Egyptian Member of Parliament Mustafa Bakri told Saudi-owned Al Arabiya TV that restoring normal relations with Turkey is important for several strategic reasons, including using Turkey's good relations with Ethiopia to ease tensions over the Renaissance Dam, which has caused consternation in Egypt because of its potential to disrupt the flow of water on the Nile. Latent tensions between Cairo and Ankara over who controls parts of Libya and undersea natural gas resources in the eastern Mediterranean have also made relations between the two countries acrimonious, and improved relations between the two countries could avoid any potential conflict in those areas as well. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
This is Science in a Minute.
When looking for extrasolar planets that might have life, scientists often look for those that reside in habitable zones or areas of a solar system where conditions could be just right for life as we know it to survive. Scientists at the University of California at Irvine provide evidence in a new study that might open up the search for extraterrestrial life beyond habitable zone planets. Unlike the planets in our solar system, many exoplanets are tidally locked to their host star. In other words, they have a permanent day and night side. One side could have scorching hot temperatures, while the other side would always be extremely cold. The UC Irvine scientists propose that areas on these planets, which they call terminator zones, that are at the dividing line between its day and night sides, could also provide conditions to harbor life. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
How do you get international news? Radio? Television? Social media? Or all of the above? Stay engaged with VOA Africa. You can call us 24/7 on WhatsApp. Leave a message, comments, or greetings. We may play your message on VOA Africa. dial the international code plus 1, then 202-258-3076.
Around the clock, the Voice of America keeps you in touch with the latest news.
Tune in at the top of every hour, every day of the week.
For the 5-Minute VOA Newscast.
We bring you reports from our correspondents and interviews with newsmakers from around the globe.
Give us 5 minutes and we'll give you the world.
VOA, your trusted source for news and information.
This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours at voanews.com. And check out voaafrica.com for more English language programming. You can find International Edition and our current affairs programs, Encounter, Press Conference USA and Issues in the News on voanews.com. Until next time, I am Chinedofa in Washington. Have a wonderful day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Following a drawn-out 5-year trial, a Cambodian court recently convicted respected Cambodian political leader Khem Sokha on fabricated charges of treason and sentenced him to 27 years, which he is currently serving under house arrest. The former leader of the Cambodian National Rescue Party was unjustly convicted on fabricated treason charges for reportedly conspiring with foreign powers to oust Prime Minister Hun Sen. Sokha, who denies the charges, was also deprived of his civil rights, including a ban on running for office and voting in elections. The United States is deeply troubled by the conviction and sentencing of Khem Sokha, said State Department spokesperson Ned Price. The multi-year process to silence him based on a politically motivated charge is unjust and profoundly diminishes the Kingdom of Cambodia's standing in the international community. The United States has consistently called on the Cambodian government to respect the human rights and fundamental freedoms of Khem Sokha and all people of Cambodia. Khem Sokha's conviction is part of a larger pattern of threats, harassment, and other unacceptable actions by Cambodian authorities to target political opposition leaders, media, and civil society, said spokesperson Price. In 2017, 2 months after Khem Sokha's arrest, the country's Supreme Court dissolved the Cambodian National Rescue Party, at the time the main opposition party. The ruling Cambodian People's Party then won all 125 seats in the 2018 national elections, turning the country into a de facto one-party state. At least 39 opposition politicians are held in Cambodian prisons, according to Amnesty International. Prosecuting and convicting individuals like Khem Sokha and many other political figures for exercising their freedoms of expression and association undermines Cambodia's constitution, international obligations, and past progress to develop as a peaceful, pluralist, and inclusive society. Spokesperson Price urged Cambodian authorities to ensure their citizens can freely exercise their human rights, including freedoms of peaceful assembly and expression, and are encouraged and able to participate in building a truly democratic system.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.